Our Lord said to them, "Go ye into the whole world and preach the gospel to every living creature."
Ferreira is lost to us. He denounced God in public and surrendered the faith.
That's not possible. Father Ferreira risked his life to spread our faith all over Japan.
It seems to me that our mission here is more urgent than ever. We must go find Father Ferreira.
This is in your hearts, then, both of you?
Yes.
Then I must trust God has put it down. The moment you set foot in that country, you step into high danger.
All right, Richard, what do you want to talk about? How do you want to do this?
So, do you want to do a little introduction or something?
Do you want me to do that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, welcome everybody to a special podcast version of Pop Theology with Richard Lindsay and myself, Ryan Parker. And we have a special guest for this episode, Mike Campos. Richard, would you like to introduce Mike?
Mike is one of our cohort from our GTU PhD class. And Mike is the, are you the co-founder of eChorus or one of the founders of eChorus?
One of the founders.
One of the founders of eChorus, which is the, please explain that.
Yeah. It's called the Emerging Queer Asian Religion Scholars. Okay. It's primarily a cohort of folks doing studies in theology and religion at the intersection of Asian communities, migration, and post-colonial conditions.
Okay.
So perfect conversation partner for a film like Silence.
Absolutely. As soon as, Ryan, as soon as you mentioned us going to see this film, which we did at this fantastic debut in our San Francisco debut in at the Castro Theater, and Scorsese was there, and Adam Driver, and Andrew Garfield, and Thelma Schoonmaker, and all of these legends were there. I just thought Mike is the guy. Mike is the person who needs to come with me to see this. So so I was really glad that we got to go along.
Well, Mike, we're thrilled to have you. And like you, so last weekend there was a screening, and some of these are taking place in New York and L.A. and San Francisco. These are some advanced screenings, word-of-mouth screenings for Silence, which is going to release closer to Christmas. Again, these screenings building a little bit of word of mouth and giving people an opportunity to hear about the journey that Scorsese took to finally making the film, which was a 28-year process. So Scorsese read the book, which is by read Silence, which is by Endo, and was, I don't know if he talked about this at your screening, but was both moved and puzzled by it. And it seems like in those intervening years, he also matured spiritually and theologically, and then began to see some of the themes that were undergirding the story and that he eventually wanted to bring to the screen. So for people who don't know, it's about two Jesuit missionaries in feudal Japan who are on the search for an apostate priest. And at this time, Christianity is not legal in Japan. And practicing or being found to be a part of a Christian community can lead to torture and death. So the stakes are very high. And as these two priests continue their search for their mentor, they too begin to experience crisis of faith. And not just crisis of faith, but also crisis, I would say, of religion. So one begins to question whether or not God exists and God is listening or responding to their prayers, hence the title of the film. And the other seems to question the practices of the church as a whole. And maybe the division's not complete, right? It's not just one, it's doing one and the other. They both wrestle with these in some ways. So it's not just a crisis of faith, but it's, should we be bringing this faith to a culture that is so completely different than theirs, which is Portuguese. So you have some fantastic characters in the film. The Chief Inquisitor, I think, should be nominated for Best Supporting Actor for the Oscars this year. And then you have Liam Neeson, who plays the apostate priest, who we don't meet until the very kind of the end of the film, who gets another strong performance. So I guess I just kind of want to open up the conversation to you guys, because we're all coming from theology backgrounds. Mike, you come from a background that will offer a very unique and fitting perspective on the story that both Richard and I don't have. So I guess the first question would be, did you like the movie? I mean, what did you make of the movie? And I personally, I mentioned this to you before we started recording, is having waited so long to see the movie, I think I probably put a lot of pressure on it. And aesthetically, you know, it's a beautiful film. The performances are great. But narratively and emotionally, I just wasn't as attuned to the film as I wanted to be, or it didn't impact me as the way that I wanted it to. But as I said before, I think theologically and intellectually, it's deeply profound and an important movie, especially for now. So that's kind of where I come from, and just kind of kick it off and see what you guys have to say.
I actually enjoy the film a lot because I'm familiar with Endo largely through another book of his, Deep River. And one of the things that I found fascinating about Endo is the way in which he treats faith, especially the relationship between Catholicism as the vehicle for faith and Japanese culture. One of the things that was very apparent to me was the fact that the two were very distinct for him, which for me, having grown up in the Philippines, the two were not distinct. In fact, the two were quite married to the other. So one of the things that I entered the film with was this idea of what it means to actually engage Christianity both as an outsider, as an insider. It was really apparent through the film for me. So that was the first thing. The second thing that I found really compelling in the film was the fact that it was undertaken by Jesuit missionaries who were going to Japan to engage the question of faith because their own mentor had actually apostatized. And in the Jesuit tradition, the idea of being part of a community is deeply rooted to them because, you know, they are essentially an extension of a military framework, right? Ignatius of Loyola was a soldier. So every Jesuit was sort of expected to care for another member of the order as if that member of the order were part of oneself. So it didn't surprise me that they were going to go into Japan to reconnect with their mentor because this was something that was deeply rooted into identities as Jesuits. And then thirdly, what was interesting for me was that as Jesuits, they had a very specific approach to conversion, and it had everything to do with how they understood the world around them at the time. I was sharing with Richard that Jesuits had very specific terms, very specific language that expressed that sensibility, the most obvious of which is that Christ is a very real person that you're in relationship with. That Christ wasn't an idea. It was really someone that you expended affection, love, investment of time, body towards. So Christ was a real person. And throughout the film, it was apparent to me that Christ was actually being reincarnated over and over again in different people. So the most obvious would be the Japanese. The second would be the actual historical Christ. And then that scene where even Rodriguez was looking at himself and seeing Christ reflected back was another form of that incarnation. And at the end of it, it was really a question of, well, where is Christ? And for a Jesuit, that's perhaps the crux of one's existential crisis. When you can't find Christ, then what does that say about the kind of world that you occupy?
One of the things you were talking about people who identified, who embodied Christ in the film, I mean, the whole film has a passion play sensibility to it. You have this continual, I mean, I love the way they staged the scene where the Japanese Christians were being essentially crucified by drowning, and that was being staged exactly in the same way as the crucifixion. There were all these little things like, you know, we'll give you 300 pieces of silver to turn in a priest. There was really the kind of the agony that the Rodriguez character goes through is really, you know, like a Gethsemane kind of agony that he's continually going through throughout the film. And, you know, we should say in terms of just the plot point, the Jesuits, I don't think that they would have had any problem accepting martyrdom. The problem was that the Japanese officials were martyring their people, were martyring their flock, their Japanese Christians, and doing it in such a way as not to bring about necessarily death, because martyrdom actually strengthens the faith. They kept saying that martyrs are the seeds of the church, but to bring about apostasy, because then apostasy actually crushes the spirit of the faith, and then people no longer, you know, people are no longer going to find it appealing. So they kept having these scenes over and over again where they were being asked to step upon. There's a Japanese name for it, but it's basically an icon, a metal icon of Christ, and to apostatize. I loved the film. I found that emotional connection to what was going on. I really felt Rodriguez's challenge and his agony. I felt like it seemed real to me. And I know all about the questions about colonialism and whether or not it's appropriate, whether it was even appropriate for them to be there trying to convert Japanese. But the feeling of his struggle felt very real to me. The struggle of the Japanese Christians felt very real to me. And that sense, it's a little bit of an old-fashioned film, because it does plumb questions of colonialism, but I think it comes out on a particular side. You know, when you see at the end, Scorsese's little—I assume it's Scorsese—but his little thing at the end with "Ad Majorem Dei Gloriam," you know, which is the Jesuit motto. You know, it's like we know which side he's come out on at that point, as to who he's rooting for in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, and you could say that it's completely his movie, right? Yeah, I mean, he waited so long and jumped through so many hoops to get this film made. I mean, that it's. Whatever is being said, he's saying it.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by this tension between, Richard, as you rightly point out, the passion play motifs behind the film. But one of when Liam Neeson telling Rodriguez, "You're not Jesus," but the film has set it up. He is Jesus.
Yes. I found myself also just as kind of a sort of a good liberal Christian. I found myself questioning my commitment to my moral relativism, because when it gets to the point where the Neeson character comes in and he's offering him a different way of looking at things, and which is different from Rodriguez's sense that he is bringing the truth to these people, I found myself really rooting for Rodriguez and wanting him to hold fast to this faith, whatever it was. And so as a sort of Western, you know, enlightenment, post-enlightenment person, you know, there was a conflict there between, on the one hand, knowing how damaging colonialism has been and how it destroys cultures, and the church is absolutely a part of that. And so on the one hand, that being a part of the church and the Western powers not allowing the Japanese people their own self-determination. But on the other hand, the fact that these Japanese Christians were being tortured by their officials. And so not allowing them their own self-determination to say, well, if they want to be a Christian, then who's to say they can't? I found myself in a good liberal conundrum, and we're really good at getting in that state.
And, you know, it's fascinating. I loved the film, but I left the film feeling actually a little bit unsettled. I was sharing with Richard as we were leaving the film that the final scene where Rodriguez was being given the final rites in a Buddhist tradition, a Buddhist rite, you know, a funereal Buddhist rite. And then the camera zooms in onto his corpse, and then clasped against his heart was really that cross that he had carved, that pretty much served as the grounding of his entire existence as a Jesuit missionary in Japan for those many years, that he still held on to it. It didn't actually leave me feeling inspired. It left me feeling, I have to say this, it left me feeling troubled about the depth of the colonial condition. Because, you know, coming from the Philippines, this narrative of martyrdom is very real for us. So, for example, the first Filipino saint, Lorenzo Ruiz, actually went to Japan as a missionary with the Dominican Order and actually died in that very same way that those people who were hung by their feet died. Like, he died because of the bloodletting. And the quotation that's often attributed to him supposedly was that if he had 1,000 lives, he would have given it all to God. And so when I was looking at that scene, one of the things that reminded me of was that, you know, Rodriguez came there to encounter a people. An encounter should transform you. Conversion is not necessarily a one-way process. One is open to the possibility of being changed to the same extent that one hopes that the people one encounters are changed because of who you are or what you bring. And there's a sense of vulnerability that that almost implies, a sense of self-emptying. I think I had written in the letter to you both, it's this sense of kenosis. So when you think of this idea of a missionary going into a foreign land, there's a sense of self-negation that happens, a loss of self. At the very end of the film, even though he had apostatized, stepped on this fumi, lived as a Japanese, suffered some form of imprisonment, and came to peace with the fact that his belief is simply beyond any comprehension or any ability on his end to control it, that clasp or grasping at that cross, even until death, for me just represented the fact that he never really was changed. In fact, it just confirmed for me the fact that he saw the Japanese as somehow totally other and perhaps even less. That at the end of the day, his Christianity, his form of Christianity, was not only a matter of his identity, but it was really a matter of belief that his tradition is really superior. And that for me was really problematic.
I think that's an amazing reading of that final scene. I saw that and wondered whether or not his wife had put that cross in his hand when she leaned over into the casket. Either way, it denies a sense of agency for the culture in which he lives, right? I think even either whether she puts it in there, whether he died holding it, the message of the film is still, this is the ultimate faith that can transcend. It can stand the fire, right?
Right.
It's going to keep going.
No. Just to add to that, because I do remember a line, and I was sort of confused by it, where they said, and his wife never wept a tear, or at least shed a tear. Mm. And that's a very Christian narrative, right? Because life doesn't end at death. So you're right. I actually think what you're suggesting may have opened up the possibility that maybe his wife was converted after all.
Well, and I also thought, I thought what Liam Neeson's character said to him had a lot of credibility. I mean, I felt like what he was saying was, you know, look, you're trying to bring a paradigm into this country that they just don't think this way. You know, they when you're telling them it's the Son of God, they're thinking it's the literal Son. And your Son of God only raises every 3 days, but their Son comes up every day. And that was reflected. You saw the first indication of that problem when they baptized the child and the couple was saying, oh, so we are now in paradise with Christ. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to explain to them, no, you're not in paradise with Christ. You will be in paradise with Christ someday. So they were not thinking in that very heady Western kind of transcending the self, dualistic kind of way. And then the Adam Driver character, Garupe, got mad, you know, got really angry at them for not getting it, which I thought was funny. But you knew that there was a problem there, and there was a hint that there was a problem there early on, that they were not perceiving this faith in the same way that the Jesuits were offering it.
Right.
Because of that, Richard, I think there's something special about the film that is of immense value to conversations about like interfaith conversations and how relationships and how we talk about theology. And it made me start to think, and Mike, a little bit about what you were saying, is if we come from a Christian background, how do we understand people's faiths that are different from our own? And it seems to me there are three approaches that we can take. There is sort of this universal truth to which we're all aspiring, and we're never going to get there. And so we're equally wrong. There's a sense that if you hold to a Christian faith, you do so vehemently and somewhat militaristically, and therefore it negates any other belief. And we maybe see some of that in the film. or there's a way in which there's honor in, and this is the third way, is probably a little problematic for me, where it's not that we're all wrong, it's that maybe we're all right. Because the all wrong answer or approach is easily understood. The approach that maybe one of us is right and everybody else is wrong is easily understood. But what if there are ways in which the unique elements of our faiths fulfill each other, or can be found in each other? Especially the way in which the interactions between Liam Neeson and Andrew Garfield's characters. To your point, Richard, there's a lot of validity to what Liam Neeson's saying that could be applicable to a Christian, to the Christian life, which Andrew Garfield's character can't hear because he has this kind of tight-fisted faith where it's either all Catholicism or nothing. But I think the film opens up the spaces for those types of conversations. But ultimately, I don't think it's siding with that more ecumenical approach. I don't know.
Well, here's why I found myself, so this is the situation I found myself in, that very unexpectedly rooting for the missionaries not to apostatize, which was very...
Oh, hey, hold on real quick. Let me just jump in real quick on not apostatizing. As a good Protestant, I was like, step all over the icon.
Oh, I know. I totally. I was like, no!
Get Luther in here. Get dry.
Keep it in the family.
Yeah,
you have to light a candle to it. Hello, people.
Anyway, when the Japanese guys were just like, it's just a formality. It's not like Jesus is going to reject you. You know, I thought
like, that was so insidious. I totally agree.
I was squirming in my seat. Anyway, go on. I wanted to grab the icon and kiss it. Go on.
So, but, you know, I found myself, strangely enough, because I was that way too. I was just like, just step on the thing. It doesn't mean anything. It's just a picture. You know, and but then towards the end, especially when he started having the conversation with Neeson, I was like, oh, wait a second. I was like, I started seeing Neeson as kind of, I didn't quite trust him. I didn't quite trust his perspective on this. And I have to say, coming from a perspective of someone in, you know, in the Presbyterian Church, we've gone through all of this, you know, years and years and years of fighting over LGBT people and their place in the church. And the thing is, we as queer Christians, LGBT Christians, we were being asked to apostatize all the time. We were constantly being told, if you would just reject this, if you would just reject what you know, which is that you are okay and God loves you as a gay Christian, we would be fine and we'll forgive you and we'll make you a part of the church again. And one of the really life-changing experiences for me was seeing one of my mentors, Janie Spar, put on trial for marrying 10 couples. And being put on trial in front of the church judiciary process, and sitting there watching that happen and watching Janie, watching her have all the power in the situation over these people who supposedly had power over her. It illuminated me to what the Christ event was all about and what it really meant when Jesus stood in front of the Sanhedrin, when he stood in front of Pilate, and when he just simply said, no, I will not recant. I will not recant who I am. I will not recant what my mission is. So I found myself rooting for them not to apostatize because I felt like I've been in that situation before. And to me, it's a confirming act of faith about the truth of the gospel, which is that oppressive forces cannot destroy the soul. That the spirit, the soul, the person's faith cannot be destroyed by oppressive forces, even in death. And I think this is not about Christianity being the only way. It's because a lot of other faith traditions have come to this conclusion too. It's similar to what Gandhi did in the Satyagraha, the soul force, that is more powerful than the worldly force. But I found myself wanting them to have that kind of moment of soul force. And in that sense, I was almost like, if these Japanese Christians, the whole question was whether or not the priests would recant and then therefore save the Japanese Christians from martyrdom. My sense is that he did them a disservice in denying them their martyrdom. That in a kind of a twisted way, although ultimately, if I were in that position, I would have done the same thing he did. In a twisted way, why deny them their martyrdom? If they're willing to do that, if they are willing to believe for whatever reason, that deeply, let them do it.
But you know, they never they couldn't deny them their martyrdom because these Japanese have recanted. That's Remember true. In the film, That's all of true. Them have all recanted.
Yeah.
And the only reason why they're being tortured was because they wanted to make sure that the Jesuits themselves recanted.
Right, yeah.
And I you know, there's a part of it where I actually almost looked at this less from an existential perspective of the person and the person's sense of integrity being put to trial as the problem that comes when two people of two very different worldviews are trying to translate to each other what one believes. Mm-hmm. I really love that talk between Neeson and Garfield, because I think for me that was the crux of what it means to really languish, perhaps suffer, or even really take into consideration the problem of conversion. You know, we always assume that this is a culture or this is a worldview that I'm imposing on the other, but it really isn't. You know, there are two very different ways in which people look at the world, and they have to translate to each other how that perspective works. Because otherwise, if that translation fails, then the conversion doesn't really transpire. And I think that was a struggle that the Jesuit missioners were encountering each time they were trying to teach these rituals to the Japanese, and the Japanese were responding in ways that they didn't expect. For example, this desire for trinkets, the desire for these crosses, pieces of rosaries, even I would argue the desire for the bodies of these Jesuits. Like, they needed a priest. I forgot the name of this particular character, that man that was constantly apostatizing.
Yeah.
Kijichiro.
That was kind of ridiculous. Kijichiro. Yeah. I mean, it was ridiculous because he was always apostatizing, which basically led me to believe it really wasn't about the faith, whatever the faith was, but it was about this particular fetish for this ritual of confession. And extend to that this particular fetish for the Jesuit mission. It has to be the Jesuit mission. It has to be the padre. It has to be the Portuguese. Whatever code that man embodies means something to Kujichiro and to the people that are there. I mean, they've essentially elevated all of these Jesuit missioners to the status of a relic. So I think what I was more interested in, and for me what was very compelling, was the fact that when you have these mistranslations happening, what choices do you make? What kind of response or moral obligation does that weigh on you when you find that you are not being fully understood and the person is not fully comprehensible to you? And, you know, at the end of the day, even though I was kind of critical about the ways in which Rodriguez died, you know, grasping at the cross, maybe that was the only thing he was really left with. At the end of it, confronted with the incomprehensibility of the world around him, the only thing he could hold on to was his own worldview, if only to assert a certain level of subjectivity. Mm. And that was the price of being a missioner. The fact that the person that you're supposed to convert will never be fully accessible to you. So you're going to have to live with that with the rest of your life. So what then do you do now? And I think Neeson had a specific response to it where he essentially abandons himself, at least that's the implication of the movie, and then enters into the other fully. Whereas on the part of Rodriguez, he pretends to abandon everything that meant anything to him, but at the end of it, he held on to it. He truly held on to it.
Mike, anyway. can you differentiate between willingly embracing the other and fleeing torture?
You know, it's kind of interesting because for me, the moment where the two, I wouldn't even say differentiate, but the moment where the two intersected for me was the moment when Rodriguez had this conversation, very personal encounter with Jesus as he was about to step on the fumi. And Jesus spoke to him and suddenly the silence descended. Everything that was happening disappeared and the silence was there. It was only Jesus speaking to him and saying, "It's okay, step on me. I have come to be, I've become one of you in order to suffer with you." At that moment, the potential difference that existed between torture and the fear of torture and the fear of apostasy and everything that that represents and being faithful to Jesus disappeared. It all became one. In fact, if you were talking about this whole psychological resolution that happens, it was basically him saying, "I'm justifying in my mind that Jesus would actually say, this is okay." I'm not convinced that that was an acquiescence. I'm not convinced that that was a sign of apostasy. I actually think that was a moment where he had to make a moral decision about who he was and what he was willing to hold on to at the moment when things were falling apart around him. So torture and I guess this sense of self and encounter at that moment were no longer so different. I actually see the two as almost conflated at that moment. I don't know if that's the question that you were asking.
No, I was. I think that's a fantastic response. I mean, we can joke about what would Jesus do?
Right.
You know, like what if Rodriguez had a bracelet? But it's like, but it's true though. I mean, but this is also, you could answer that question in one way, of course Jesus would have stepped on the icon. Of course he would have prevented the suffering of all these people, right? But you have a lot of people who would also answer it a different way and say, well, if Jesus were there, he'd have been a Christian and he'd have been martyred with the rest of them. And, you know, this whole thing, you know, I think I would cast my lot with one of those approaches more than I would the other. But, no, I think you make a great point about they don't necessarily have to be either or.
And can I add one more thing? You know, it's kind of interesting because there is a trend, at least in Catholic theology, particularly liberation theology, where there's a certain resistance around the narrative that Jesus would willingly embrace suffering and death for people. You know, that is one trope that's oftentimes prevalent in I would say, Western North American theology, right?
Yeah, but all the atonement theories.
Exactly. And that might not have been the worldview in which Jesus was living. You know, like, for example, in liberation theology, there's a rereading that Jesus's choices were quite pragmatic, that he wanted to encourage people to be good Jews. And at the end of it, those very pragmatic choices basically resulted in him being crucified like a common criminal. So he wasn't going to the cross. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I definitely take the perspective of murdered, not sacrificed. I preached this sermon in a sermon class one time in divinity school, and my Presbyterian, you know, instructor almost just blanched, where I said, you know, Jesus didn't have to die, you know, and there were choices that were made that led to him dying. You know, he just freaked out when it came to that. And it was not some great, you know, plan on the part of God that this just happened. You know, this is of the shit happened school of theology. And then God tries to make something of that. You know, the resurrection then is what's important is that the suffering does have the possibility of transformation, at least in a larger spiritual sense, not that suffering is to be sought out. I also, though, feel like that, you know, there comes a time, though, when maybe this is, again, I don't know how the Jesuits would think of this, but when the faith becomes so intrinsic to who you are, that to apostatize is essentially to commit a kind of suicide. I keep thinking about this experience as a gay Presbyterian. I could no more apostatize that faith as a gay Presbyterian than you know, it's like you can hang me from a limb and you know, put me out to sea and make me drown and whatever. I could apostatize all I wanted, but it wouldn't change anything. My faith in being a person of faith who is queer is not going to change. And there's no amount of pressure that can be applied either by the church or if, you know, God forbid, some kind of a government authority that could really change that in me.
I think you both of you make good points that I think lead into maybe a place where we can kind of close this or wrap this up. First, I think, you know, to both your point about Jesus, we can talk about Jesus coming to die, right? To be sacrificed on humanity's behalf. I mean, I think to do that ignores the real religious, economic, and political realities that Jesus lived in, which have been mirrored throughout history and resulted in countless crucifixions, even to today. And I think one of the things that silence does well is to bring in those political, economic, and religious implications of what the Jesuit missionaries were doing in Japan. That being said, Richard, you touch on a little bit about ways in which we can find contemporary parallels in this movie. And I wonder if you guys talked about that after your screening, if it made you see the world now differently. Because I think great movies do that. They force us to look at our world a little bit differently.
Well, you know, my sense is with you, Mike, it was like you went in there thinking like that Filipino schoolboy who had heard those stories, and you were expecting to see this kind of...
I know. I wanted to cry. Like, weep my heart.
And like, you came out of there. You
throw myself with the marinoles, go to Latin America and something. Anyway, but when I read Endo, it was very apparent to me that... when I read Deep River, that Endo's relationship with Catholicism almost deemed it as a foreign element to Japanese culture, as if there were two different cultures that sort of coexisted, one layered on top of the other. They were not really integrated. In fact, there were moments where they blended in beautifully, but there were moments when they were clearly distinct. And I saw that also in the film, you know, again, this idea that there's a missionary from a particular worldview and culture, and then there's a local version of it. And even amongst the converts, there was misinterpretation happening. So that was sort of a common trope between the two books for me. So one of the things that I was really curious about was, what does it mean for us to really encounter the other? And maybe this goes back to what Ryan was asking me earlier. Like, what does encountering the other really mean? Especially in a world where more and more people are more conscious about the fact that there are others in our midst. And the one thing that the film left me sort of feeling uncomfortable about was the impossibility of that encounter. That at the end of it, there was something paradoxical about the fact that as a missionary, you're supposed to submit to this call. But that for Rodriguez, that act of final submission was so impossible that he ultimately didn't submit. And so was that a failed encounter? So that was, for me, the more existential issue. On a practical level, it also raises for me the idea of, well, then how in the world are we ever going to transcend some of the limitations and paradigms around racism, around ways in which socioeconomic injustice, class distinctions, how are we ever going to really encounter the other? You know, because there's such an impossibility around being able to fully translate and being able to fully empathize. So empathy for me became another theme that sort of emerged from the film. Are we ever going to be able to truly empathize with the other person? Yeah. I find that the impossibility of that was kind of hard to take.
Yeah.
Well, Richard. I think what you might be fishing for, Ryan, is in terms of the election. And
I'm not fishing.
You're aware of this, Ryan. I mean, I just moved from Louisiana back to civilization. And in Louisiana, you know, what the thing I found like really frustrating was this kind of worship of the Second Amendment, and that, you know, I could find a lot of, you know, overlap and places of agreement with people in Louisiana on various topics, but this was one thing where I just simply couldn't. And you know, the fact that, you know, there was a theater shooting in Lafayette when I was there, and all anybody could do is just stand there. They just stood there going, how could this happen? How could this happen? And they just kept saying that over and over and over again. And, you know, putting signs all over the city that said Lafayette strong. But it was like an abstract evil had attacked them rather than it being a reflection of their own choices. And you could never explain that to them, no matter how hard you tried. They simply could not hear it. So my sense of what the election left me with was that I had always been thinking, we need a religious left to counter the religious right. But what this election left me thinking is, we need a religious left for the sake of the left, that the left needs to undergo its own spiritual transformation and stop trying to change everyone else. You know, it's like, if we really live into our principles at the very deepest level, then it in some ways it simply doesn't matter what the rest of the country is doing and what they're thinking. We're not gonna win everybody over to our way of thinking about things. So let's think about how we can do this in a more intentional and I would say spiritual way, rather than simply looking for material gain in the form of winning at politics.
Yeah, you got to where I was fishing to go, which wasn't explicitly about the election, yeah. Right? And any sort of there are justifiable fears that are very prevalent at the moment. But it really had me thinking about the ways in which we live and behave as people of faith affect people of faith around the world, whether we know it or not, mm-hmm. You know? And we hear that here. We hear that from Christians who are living and serving and working abroad, whether they're missionaries or not, right?
Right.
They'll say the way Americans treat Muslims in the United States directly affects the way Christians are treated abroad, right? And even more so, I mean, now that we live in such a hyper-connected world, Mike, like you were talking about earlier, it's those realities are much, much closer. And so, Richard, to your point, it's we don't need to convince anybody by words or anything, right? We need to live in such a way that is transformative, for lack of a better word, or just, or however, you know, whatever word you want to use. So I don't know that it's one thing I was trying to trace to other than this reality that the way we live and treat others affects others beyond that initial relationship or community.
Yeah. Can I add something to that? You know, I appreciate the clarification, or at least what you were trying to sort of think about, you know, Ryan, because I teach at a Catholic high school. And it's an interesting high school because in so many ways, it's an independent, rather wealthy high school where our student body is probably 50% identify as Catholic, and even less than that actually are practicing Catholics, which means that the majority of our student body are probably not even attuned to the Catholic worldview and language that many of us take for granted. And that has always raised a lot of questions in terms of how we would like to articulate our own identity as a religious school. But even to go deeper than that, it's really how to live that out in the everyday. So I'm in the theology department. I teach ethics and I teach world religions. And every year a kid would actually say to me, because I really enjoyed your class, it's the least religious class I've ever taken. And I would almost sort of like half laugh, like, oh God, I'm gonna get fired. But at the end of the day, I feel like I'm actually able to tap into a sensibility around religious questions that more traditional religion teachers have been unable to. Which means, again, to go back to this whole question of encounters, I look at encounters as really an experience of encountering signs and the possibility of being mistranslated. And when I go into a classroom every day with these guys that have not grown up with my own worldview, with my own assumptions around faith, it's really a matter of trying to translate for them and helping them translate for me how our worldviews intersect. And the fact that a guy would say, oh, I really enjoyed your class. It's, you know, it's really awesome. The questions are great. And it's not religious. You know, I take it with a grain of salt because I realize that he's really appreciating the religious questions, but in a way that's comprehensible. And perhaps that's where what we would call an encounter is possible. As it is, religion is such a politically loaded term that most people don't even want to touch it anymore. And as a result, even religious people, and I go back to what Richard was talking about, you know, the religious left, we tend to either, well, I'm just going to be totally secular and I'm totally going to be social justice and not even address the question of religion because it's just too loaded. Or we go onto the opposite direction where we embrace religious rituals and signifiers as if they were the only essence of religious life.
I think this is like the perfect wrap-up.
I think we need to watch movies more with Mike.
I'm always in favor of watching movies with Mike.
I don't think I can do this much insight unless I'm tapped into the culture. Half the movies that you guys are watching, I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
I pray, but I'm lost. Am I just praying to silence?